A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about something that most of us have probably wondered about at some point, and then filed away as too complicated to untangle. Here's what he wrote. One topic I've always found a little confusing is the relationship between the military and civilian law enforcement in a democracy. When we picture a country like the United States or Israel, we tend to think of the police as the people who enforce the law and the military as the organization responsible for defending the country from external threats. But where exactly is the line between those two institutions? Under ordinary circumstances, does the military have any authority to enforce civilian law, to arrest people, investigate crimes, or otherwise act as a police force? Or are those powers deliberately reserved for civilian law enforcement? He's got more. Hang on, then there are the situations where you hear that the army has been deployed to restore law and order, after riots, natural disasters, or other emergencies. What legal changes take place in those cases? Does the military temporarily acquire policing powers, or does it operate in support of the police under strict limits? More broadly, in the day-to-day running of a democratic state, how much interaction is there between the military and the police? Are they largely firewalled from one another? Or do they routinely cooperate behind the scenes? And how do different democracies, perhaps the United States, Israel, the United Kingdom, and France, draw that boundary in different ways? That's a genuinely thorny question, because the answer is different depending on which democracy you're standing in. And even in a single country, the answer changes the moment you declare an emergency.
And the thing is, the line feels obvious until you actually try to find it on a map. Most people can tell you the military fights wars and the police walk beats. But the moment you ask, "Can a soldier arrest me?" suddenly nobody knows the answer, and the answer they don't know is different in Dallas than it's in Tel Aviv.
Which is exactly what makes Daniel's question worth an entire episode. So let's start by untangling what we actually mean when we say, the military can't police civilians, because that statement is true in some places and completely false in others.
Right. The core tension here is that democracies rest on a separation between the instruments of external violence and internal order. The military handles threats from outside the border. The police handle threats inside. But that separation is a legal construct, not a natural one. It has to be actively maintained by statutes, court rulings, and institutional culture, and if you stop maintaining it, it erodes.
Because if you go back far enough in history, this distinction barely existed. The Roman legions built roads and collected taxes. Medieval kings used the same armed retinue to fight wars and suppress rebellions. The idea that you'd have two entirely separate organizations with different legal powers, different training, different chains of command, that's a surprisingly modern invention.
It really is. The first modern police force, the London Metropolitan Police, wasn't founded until 1829, and a big part of the argument for creating it was precisely to have a civilian force that wasn't the army. People were deeply uncomfortable with soldiers patrolling the streets, so from the very beginning, the police were designed to be unarmed or lightly armed in blue uniforms rather than red, accountable to magistrates rather than the crown directly. The whole aesthetic of modern policing was built around not being the military.
Which makes the modern trend toward police militarization doubly ironic. But we'll get to that. For now, the anchor for this whole conversation, at least in the American context, is a statute most people have heard of, but few have actually read. The Posse Comitatus Act,
1878, codified at Title 18, Section 1385 of the U.S. Code. And what it says, in plain terms, is that it's a federal crime to use any part of the Army or the Air Force to execute civilian law, unless the Constitution or Congress expressly authorizes it.
Which immediately raises the question, wait, what about the Navy and the Marine Corps?
That's the first thing everyone notices. The statute as written only names the Army and the Air Force. The Navy and Marine Corps aren't technically covered by the text. But And this is where the institutional culture part comes in. The Department of Defense has a directive, DoD Directive 5525.5, that applies the exact same restriction to all branches. So in practice, the firewall covers the entire U.S. military. It's just that for the Navy and Marines, it's policy rather than criminal statute.
Which seems like a pretty significant gap, honestly. If you're a stickler for statutory text, you could argue that a Marine unit technically could be used for domestic law enforcement without violating posse comitatus itself. It'd violate DoD policy, sure, but policy can be changed with a pen stroke. The statute requires an act of Congress.
And it's one of those things that keeps constitutional lawyers up at night. The policy firewall is strong, but it's not ironclad in the same way a criminal statute is. If a future administration wanted to push the envelope, the Navy and Marine Corps are the obvious pressure points. There's actually a small body of scholarship arguing that Congress should amend posse comitatus to explicitly cover all branches, precisely to close that gap.
So, the firewall is real, but it's also a patchwork of statute and policy. And the moment you start looking at the exceptions, the patchwork gets even more interesting.
Let's start with the biggest exception, because it's the one people actually see in the news. The Insurrection Act of 1807.
Which has been amended a few times.
Most recently in 2006, after Hurricane Katrina. The original act allows the president to deploy federal troops to suppress insurrection, domestic violence, unlawful combinations, or conspiracies that obstruct the execution of state or federal law. The 2006 amendment broadened it slightly to include natural disasters and public health emergencies, but it's still an emergency power, not a routine one.
And the Katrina amendment is worth pausing on, because it was controversial. The original act was about insurrection and domestic violence, situations where the rule of law itself had broken down. Adding natural disasters and public health emergencies expanded the trigger to situations where the problem isn't lawlessness, it's overwhelmed capacity. The hurricane didn't stage a rebellion, the hospitals were just full.
And that expansion worried a lot of civil libertarians, because it blurred the line between a breakdown of order and a breakdown of capacity. In an insurrection, you're dealing with people actively defying the law. In a hurricane, you're dealing with people who need rescue and relief. Sending in the army for the latter feels humanitarian, but it also normalizes military deployment in a way that can slide into the former.
This is the kind of thing Daniel was getting at when he asked what legal changes take place. And this is the statute people are thinking of when they say the president sent in the army. But here's the thing. Even under the Insurrection Act, the troops aren't automatically police officers. The act authorizes deployment. It doesn't automatically confer arrest powers over civilians. The rules of engagement still matter enormously.
And that brings us to the distinction that actually does the work in practice, enforcement versus support. When the U.S. military operates domestically, the key question is whether they're enforcing the law, arresting people, conducting investigations, seizing evidence, or whether they're supporting civilian authorities with logistics, security for specific sites, transportation, communications.
Enforcement is the red line. Support is routine.
And the National Guard complicates this picture in a way that confuses a lot of news coverage. The Guard can operate in three different legal statuses. State active duty. That's when the governor calls them up for something like a flood or a riot, and they're under state control. Title 32 status. Still under state control, but funded by the federal government, and the governor can use them for law enforcement. Then Title 10 status, federalized, under presidential command, and bound by posse comitatus.
So when you saw National Guard troops in the streets during the 2020 protests, those were mostly Title 32 deployments. Governors could use them for law enforcement. If the president had federalized those same troops under Title 10, the legal picture would have changed entirely.
And that's exactly what happened in the 1992 Los Angeles riots. President George H.W. Bush federalized the California National Guard and also deployed active duty Marines and Army troops. But, and this is the part that gets lost, they operated under strict rules of engagement that kept them in support of local police. They provided security for firefighters. They guarded intersections. They created a perimeter. They didn't conduct arrests or investigations themselves. The LAPD and the Sheriff's Department still made the arrests.
I want to linger on that LA riots example, because it's such a perfect illustration of how the visual and the legal diverge. If you were in Los Angeles in May of 1992, you saw Marines in full combat gear standing on street corners. It looked like martial law. But if you actually tried to trace the chain of custody on any arrest made during that deployment, it went through a civilian police officer every single time. The Marines were essentially providing a secure perimeter within which civilian policing could resume.
And that distinction mattered enormously for the legal aftermath. If a Marine had arrested someone, that arrest would have been vulnerable to a constitutional challenge. The evidence could have been suppressed. The whole prosecution could have collapsed. So the operational choice to keep Marines in support roles wasn't just about principle. It was about making sure the arrest would hold up in court.
Which is a very lawyerly way to think about a riot. But that's the system working as designed. The legal constraints shaped the operational behavior. So the visual of soldiers in the street doesn't equal soldiers acting as police. The visual is misleading, which is why Daniel's question about what actually changes legally is the right question to ask.
Let me address the arrest question directly because it's the most concrete version of what Daniel's asking. Under ordinary circumstances, no emergency, no special authorization, a U.S. soldier has no more arrest authority over a civilian than any private citizen. Which is to say, citizens arrest in limited circumstances, and that's it. The military's internal law enforcement, military police, the Criminal Investigation Division, only has jurisdiction over military personnel and military installations. A military police officer at Fort Hood can't arrest a civilian in downtown Killeen. They don't have the legal authority.
Can we make that even more concrete? Let's say you're at a bar near a military base, and a soldier and a civilian get into a fight. The military police show up. What happens?
The military police can detain the soldier. They have full jurisdiction over military personnel anywhere on or off base. But the civilian? The best they can do is detain them briefly and call the local civilian police. They can't process the arrest themselves. They can't file charges. They can't put the civilian in a military holding cell except in the most temporary sense while waiting for civilian authorities. If they did, any evidence they gathered would be inadmissible in civilian court, and the military would be exposed to a civil rights lawsuit.
So even in a situation where military personnel and civilians are mixed up in the same incident, the legal wall is absolute. The MP's authority stops at the civilian status.
And that's not a gap in the law. That's the point of the law.
Right. The entire Posse Comitatus framework exists because of a specific historical anxiety. Reconstruction. After the Civil War, federal troops were stationed throughout the South, and they were used to enforce federal law, including protecting the rights of newly freed black Americans. The Posse Comitatus Act was passed in 1878 as part of the political compromise that ended Reconstruction. Southern Democrats wanted the federal military out of their states, and this was the mechanism.
And it's worth being blunt about what enforcing federal law meant in that context. It meant federal troops preventing the Ku Klux Klan from terrorizing black voters. It meant soldiers guarding polling places during elections. It meant the military acting as the only institution willing and able to protect civil rights in the face of local police departments that were either complicit or actively participating in the violence.
So the firewall was built, in part, to enable Jim Crow. That's an uncomfortable fact, but it's a fact. The same statute that today protects civil liberties was originally designed to protect the ability of southern states to oppress their black citizens without federal interference.
Which is why I said earlier that this boundary is a choice, not a law of nature. The same legal tool can serve completely different purposes depending on the context. In 1878, Posse Comitatus was a tool of racial oppression. Today, it's generally understood as a civil liberties safeguard. The statute didn't change, the context did.
So the American firewall isn't some abstract democratic principle that fell from the sky. It's a product of a very specific political fight, and it's worth remembering that when you compare it to other countries.
Which brings us to the comparative part of Daniel's question. And here's where it gets interesting. The U.S. firewall isn't the democratic norm. Take a flight to Tel Aviv or Paris, and the whole picture changes.
Let's start with Israel, since Daniel mentioned it specifically.
Israel has no Posse Comitatus equivalent. None. The Israel Defense Forces routinely operate as a domestic police force in the occupied territories. Checkpoints, patrols, arrests, investigations. and in practice, within Israel proper during security emergencies, the IDF and the police coordinate on counterterrorism as a matter of routine, not exception. The military's role in internal security is baked into the state's founding logic.
And the reason is straightforward. Israel has faced existential security threats from its neighbors since 1948. The distinction between external and internal threats collapses when the external threat is a terrorist cell operating inside your cities. So the institutional boundary between the IDF and the Israel police is porous by design, not by accident.
And here's a concrete example that illustrates how different the mental model is. In Israel, there's a concept called Hamotza Lebitakon Leomi, the National Security Council, that coordinates between the military, the police, and the intelligence services. It's not an emergency body. It's a permanent standing institution. The assumption is that these organizations need to be in constant operational contact, not firewalled from each other.
Intelligence sharing, joint operation centers, coordinated patrols in sensitive areas. All of that's normal operating procedure. In the West Bank, IDF soldiers are effectively the police. They man checkpoints, they conduct arrests, they investigate security offenses. The Israel police have a presence there too, but the military is the primary instrument of order. If you're an American looking at this, your instinct might be to say, well, that's not a normal democracy. But that's the wrong framing. Israel is a democracy with a fundamentally different threat profile, and its institutional arrangements reflect that. The boundary between military and police is a choice, not a law of nature.
Now let's go to France, because France does something that breaks the American brain in a completely different way. They have a military force, the Gendarmerie Nationale, that serves as a rural and highway police force. These are soldiers. They have military ranks, they live in barracks, they fall under the Ministry of the Armed Forces for some purposes. But they also patrol highways, investigate crimes, and make arrests, just like civilian police.
Wait, they're military, and they do routine traffic stops.
Routine traffic stops, domestic violence calls, burglary investigations. The gendarmerie handles policing for about half of France's population, mostly rural areas and small towns. The civilian police nationale handles the cities. And the two forces coordinate daily.
If you're speeding on a country road in the Loire Valley and you get pulled over, the person writing your ticket might be a soldier, with full military status, who could theoretically be deployed to a war zone next month.
Here's the part that really confuses Americans. The gendarmerie's military status isn't some legal fiction. They've armored vehicles. They have a cyber warfare division. They deploy on overseas military operations. A gendarme could spend 6 months doing drug investigations in rural Burgundy and then deploy to Mali as part of a counterterrorism operation. The same person, the same legal authority, just operating in completely different contexts.
France just fused them.
Deliberately. And it's not unique to France. Italy has the Carabinieri, also a military force with civilian policing powers. Spain has the Guardia Civil. The Netherlands has the Koninklijke Marechaussee. This is a whole model of policing that the Anglo-American world finds strange, but that much of continental Europe considers completely normal.
The historical roots matter here, too. The gendarmerie traces its lineage back to the Marechaussee of the Middle Ages, a military force that handled highway patrol and law enforcement in rural areas. This isn't some 20th century innovation. It's a continuous institutional tradition that predates modern democracy itself. The French never developed the sharp military-police separation because they never had the historical moment that produced it in the United States.
The gendarmerie has been deployed in some of France's most high-profile domestic crises. The 2005 riots, the 2018 to 2019 Yellow Vest protests, the gendarmerie was the primary instrument of internal order. During those protests, the French government also deployed regular army units in support roles, guarding sensitive sites, freeing up police and gendarmes for frontline duty. But the army wasn't making arrests. The gendarmerie was.
Even within the French model, there's still a distinction between the gendarmerie and the regular army. The gendarmerie has policing powers. The regular army, when deployed domestically, operates in support. It's not a free-for-all.
Which brings us to the UK. And the UK is interesting because it sits somewhere between the American firewall and the French fusion model. There's no posse comitatus statute in British law. But there's a very strong constitutional convention that the military doesn't engage in domestic law enforcement except in extremis. The principle is called military aid to the civil power, MACAPEE.
The key phrase there is aid to the civil power. The military is aiding. The civil power, the police, is in charge.
The most visible recent example was Operation Temperor after the Manchester Arena bombing in May 2017. The government deployed up to 5,000 troops to guard key sites, nuclear facilities, government buildings, major transport hubs, but those troops operated under police command. They had no independent arrest authority over civilians. They were there to free up armed police officers for patrol and response duties.
The visual was soldiers with rifles at train stations, but the legal reality was that they were essentially security guards with military discipline.
That's the British model in a nutshell. The military can be called out to support the police in counterterrorism, in natural disasters, in industrial disputes. But they operate under police command, and they don't acquire policing powers just by being deployed. The police remain the police.
The British are almost religious about this distinction. I remember during the 2012 London Olympics, there was a controversy about putting surface-to-air missiles on apartment buildings. The missiles were operated by soldiers, and people asked, "Does this mean the military is now policing London's airspace?" The government's answer was emphatically no. This is a military operation to defend against an external air threat, not a policing operation. The distinction was maintained even when it looked absurdly thin.
Because in the British constitutional imagination, the idea of the army policing civilians is associated with the most dangerous moments in their history, the Peterloo Massacre of 1819, the use of troops against striking workers, Northern Ireland. The convention against it's strong precisely because the historical memory of what happens when it breaks down is so vivid.
We've got four democracies. Four different models. The US, with a statutory firewall and criminal penalties for crossing it. Israel, with a porous boundary driven by existential threats. France, with a dedicated military police force that handles routine civilian policing. The UK, with a constitutional convention of military support under police command.
That variation tells you something important. The boundary between military and police isn't a universal democratic principle. It's a product of each country's history and threat perception. The U.S. firewall comes from Reconstruction. Israel's porous boundary comes from the security situation. France's gendarmerie comes from the Napoleonic tradition of centralized state control. The U.K.'s MACAPEE comes from centuries of common law evolution.
Now, Daniel also asked about day-to-day interaction, and this is where the picture gets more complicated than the statutes suggest. Even in the U.S., with its strict firewall, there's routine, extensive cooperation between the military and civilian law enforcement.
The National Guard's counter-drug program is a good example. Guard units provide reconnaissance, intelligence analysis, and logistics support to civilian drug enforcement agencies. They fly surveillance aircraft, they run communications networks, they provide training. They're not making arrests. The DEA or local police do that, but they're deeply embedded in the operational pipeline.
Let's put a concrete image on that. In some states, National Guard analysts sit in the same room as DEA agents, looking at the same intelligence feeds, helping to identify trafficking routes and patterns. The Guard analyst is in uniform. The DEA agent is not. They're working the same problem. The only thing the guard analyst can't do is sign an arrest warrant or testify as the arresting officer.
The border. Operation Jumpstart 2006 to 2008 deployed National Guard troops to the U.S.-Mexico border. They built fencing, they ran surveillance equipment, they provided transportation and communications. Again, not making arrests. Border Patrol did that, but they were there, in uniform, working alongside civilian law enforcement for 2 years.
2 years is a long time to have troops on the border. At what point does a temporary deployment become a permanent institutional arrangement?
That's exactly the question civil liberties groups were asking by the end of Operation Jumpstart. And it's a question that's only gotten more urgent with subsequent border deployments. The pattern is, a crisis is declared, troops are deployed in a support role, the deployment gets extended and extended again, and eventually you have a semi-permanent military presence that nobody quite intended to create, but that nobody can quite figure out how to end.
There are also joint task forces on terrorism and intelligence. The Defense Department runs counter-drug intelligence centers that feed analysis to civilian agencies. The FBI's joint terrorism task forces include military personnel. The firewall is about who can arrest and investigate, not about who can share information or provide logistics.
The day-to-day picture isn't two institutions in separate buildings ignoring each other. It's two institutions that talk constantly, share intelligence, train together in some cases, and coordinate on everything from border security to disaster response, but with a bright legal line at the point of arrest and investigation.
That brings us to the knock-on effect that I think is the most interesting part of this whole conversation. The militarization of the police.
Right. Because while the U.S. has this elaborate legal machinery to keep the military out of civilian policing, it also has a program, the 1033 program, that transfers surplus military equipment to local police departments.
Since the 1990s, the Department of Defense has transferred billions of dollars worth of equipment to civilian police. Armored vehicles, night vision goggles, assault rifles, grenade launchers, bayonets. And the program accelerated after the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan because there was a huge surplus of equipment coming back.
You have a civilian police department in a town of 10,000 people driving an MRAP, a mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicle designed for counterinsurgency warfare. But legally, the officers inside are civilians operating under civilian law. The equipment is military. The legal constraints are not.
That's the irony. Posse comitatus prevents the military from policing civilians, but it does nothing to prevent the police from looking and acting like the military. The 1033 program is a channel for military capabilities to enter civilian law enforcement that completely bypasses the posse comitatus firewall.
Because the firewall is about who holds the badge, not what equipment they have.
A soldier with an M4 can't arrest you. A police officer with an M4 from the 1033 program absolutely can. The legal difference is enormous. The visual difference is zero.
Which creates a weird situation where the public sees what looks like a military operation. Armored vehicles, tactical gear, SWAT teams breaching doors, and assumes the military is involved. But legally, it's all civilian. The military is nowhere near it.
There's a feedback loop here that's worth naming. The more the police look like the military, the more the public's mental model of the military-police boundary erodes. People see a map rolling down their street and think the army is here. They're wrong legally, but they're not wrong about what it looks like. And over time, that visual erosion might make actual military deployment feel less exceptional. If the police already have tanks, what's the big deal if the army shows up with theirs?
That's a chilling thought, but I think it's exactly right. The cultural boundary and the legal boundary reinforce each other. When the cultural boundary weakens, the legal boundary becomes easier to challenge politically, even if the statutes haven't changed.
That confusion is part of why Daniel's question is so important. Most people don't know how to read a news story about troops being deployed because they don't know which questions to ask.
Let's give them the questions. That's the practical takeaway from all of this.
The single most useful mental model is enforcement versus support. When you hear that the military has been deployed domestically, the key question is whether they have arrest and investigation authority, enforcement, or whether they're providing logistics, security for specific sites, or backfilling police roles, support. The former is rare and legally fraught. The latter is common.
In the U.S. specifically, the second question is legal status. Title 10 means federal control and posse comitatus restrictions. Title 32 means state control and possible law enforcement authority. State active duty means the governor can use them however state law permits. That status determines everything about what the troops can legally do.
For other countries, the question is different. In Israel, the military and police are operationally integrated. The relevant question is, which legal framework governs the specific operation, not whether the military can be involved at all. In France, the question is whether the force in question is the gendarmerie, military but with full policing powers, or regular army units operating in a support role. In the UK, the question is whether the deployment is under police command, MACP, or something more unusual.
The deeper civic takeaway is that this boundary is a choice. Every democracy makes it, and every democracy can unmake it. The erosion of the boundary, whether through police militarization, through routine military domestic deployments, or through emergency powers that become permanent, is worth watching as a democratic health indicator.
One last thing worth thinking about. Where is this heading? Climate change is driving more frequent natural disasters. Political polarization is driving more domestic unrest. The Insurrection Act amendments and the 2020 deployments suggest pressure is building on the U.S. firewall.
The rise of domestic terrorism and the blurring of external and internal threats, cyber, disinformation, may push more democracies toward the Israeli or French model, or it may reinforce the firewall as a democratic safeguard. Both forces are in play right now.
If you're listening and thinking, I had no idea the Gendarmerie was a military force. Or wait, the Navy isn't covered by Posse Comitatus. That's the point. This stuff is hidden in plain sight, and Daniel's question pulled it into the light.
If this episode changed how you read the news, or if you have a weird prompt of your own, send it to us. We read everyone.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.